counseling people who are on psychological drugs. I always start out talking about this by doing the, you know, it's the part in those drug commercials, you know what I'm talking about? They're talking along about all, first they show you the sad face, and then they show you the happy face, and, you know, the distance from the sad face to the happy face obviously has to do with the product they're selling. But then when they get done showing you the happy face, the voice shifts gears. You ever notice that? It's like the voice drops down about 10 decibels and it starts talking about 50% faster. And all the time they're telling you that your hair could fall out, you might die, you could have seizures, et cetera, you could kill yourself, et cetera, so on and so forth. And it's the legal disclaimer. Well, you know, I sort of have that, but it really isn't because I'm afraid you're going to sue me. It's just I don't want to be killed before the evening's over. Boy, tough crowd. Okay, yes, I need a drummer badly, don't I? I never could tell jokes. The part that I like to talk about right this moment is Romans 14. And I always talk about it whenever I lecture briefly. And the reason why is because I want you to know that taking medicine for depression or for anxiety or for whatever indication the doctor says that you have is a Romans 14 issue. It's a matter of liberty. It's a matter of choice. Paul in Romans 14 was talking about the argument. Imagine that. They had arguments back in the first century in churches. I think they still do, don't they? Yeah, I think they do. And back then they were arguing about whether it was right to eat meat or not. And the meat that they were worried about was meat offered to idols. And some folks wanted to be vegetarians. They're still arguing about that, aren't they? And some folks wanted to be meat eaters. And of course, the issue was the meat was offered to idols. And Paul said in Romans 14 that, in essence, is that it made absolutely no difference. The idol didn't exist, therefore the meat offered to the idol didn't mean anything. So the people who ate the meat weren't doing anything wrong, and the people who didn't eat the meat weren't exactly doing anything right, one way or the other. But the thing that he was really upset with them about was that they were judging one another. The people who ate the meat would talk about their weaker brethren. You've all heard that, haven't you, at one time or another? It's usually centering around arguments about whether you go to movies or eat in a restaurant that serves liquor. You know, when I was a kid, that was a big deal. I don't think it's much of an issue anymore. But you know, you were always worried about, if I went and saw a Walt Disney movie, would it offend the weaker brethren? You know, and they might go watch a worse movie than the Walt Disney movie I went to. Anyway, Paul said that the wrong at Rome was that the meat eaters were judging the vegetable eaters, and the vegetable eaters were judging the meat eaters. And so what I would tell you is that taking medicine really is a Romans 14 issue. There is nothing said in the scriptures about whether it's right or wrong to take medicine for anything. It doesn't really speak of it much. And honestly, the issue really isn't whether it's right or wrong. And I can tell you this as a physician, as someone who's done biblical counseling for a long time, if you get hung up on that rock, you will miss the important issue. The important issue is, does the medicine work? That should be the question we're actually working on. Does this medicine actually work? And are the side effects that you will suffer, and you will, the side effects that you will suffer, are they worth the benefit that you're supposed to get? So I always tell people, I'm not going to have any nasty arguments with anybody up here after I'm done. You know, it's like, don't come up. I've had people come up and want to tear my clothes off and set me on fire before this was over. And some of them didn't even want to wait until the lecture was over. And I'm not going to do that tonight. I won't argue with you about it. Because I'm not going to judge you about whether you take medicine or if you do or if you don't. And quite equally, you should not judge me if my opinions about it are different than yours. All right? So, that's the disclaimer. Our goal in biblical counseling is not to get everybody to quit taking their medicine. The goal of our instruction, as Paul said to Timothy, is love. The goal of our instruction is love, and we want to help people who are struggling in life see what the scriptures have to say about the struggles which they have and come to understand how the grace of God could work in their lives in such a way that they could live in a way that they wouldn't have to worry so much, or they wouldn't need to be depressed so much. That's what the goal of biblical counseling is, to lovingly come alongside people and show them out of the Word of God how they can grow and change and become more like Christ. All right, so let's get on with it. Now, the first question is, are these medications necessary with regard to biblical counseling? Okay? And the answer is, requires you to understand the difference between medicine and psychiatry. And I want to talk about this a little bit more later, perhaps when we get down to the Q&A time, because I've actually read a really good book that has a history of it. And so I'll tell you a little bit more about that later. But the difference between medicine and psychiatry has to do with how you define disease. And I would say as a physician, it has to do with pathology. Disease always has pathology. Pathology is some misfunction or dysfunction or damage at a cell level which causes the organ in the body to not work like it's supposed to. And as a result, people then have symptoms. The best case one is the ones that the psychiatrists use to try to convince people that depression is a disease. They use diabetes. Why? Because at a cell level in the pancreas, there's either a dysfunction in which you do not produce enough insulin, or as we eat too many Twinkies and Ho-Hos and what is it? Hickeys. Yes, we eat too long at Hickeys. Our body's cells lose their ability to import the sugar into them in a normal way because, well, we get too big. And so there is at a cellular level, there is an abnormality. And that abnormality can be measured. Every time, every diabetic, nobody who has a normal blood sugar has diabetes, period. And people who have abnormal blood sugars, people who have blood sugars of 200, 300, 400, 500, 800, whatever, they have diabetes, and you can always divide it out that way. Why? Because there is pathology in the pancreas, and there are abnormal blood tests to confirm it. Now, that's how we have been looking at disease and medicine since about 1850. Now, psychiatry, on the other hand, doesn't look at it that way. In medicine, there are definite organic causes of behavior problems. However, when a truly organic cause is found for that behavior problem, a medical diagnosis is given. We see behavior problems in diseases like Cushing's, which is an abnormality of the adrenal glands. People can become psychotic as a result. Hyperthyroidism, you might think that they were anxious and nervous or that they were pulling their hair out, but they really have Graves' disease. Their thyroid's running too fast. Cancer of the pancreas, people get depressed. Pica. Pica is a favorite. Pica is when little kids eat dirt and wallboard, and when pregnant women eat whole bags of carrots and whole gallons of ice cream. They sit down with a spoon and eat a whole gallon of ice cream, or they sit down and they eat a whole bag of carrots. Or some people who eat ice compulsively. You ever know anybody who chewed ice all the time? Maybe even chewed ice so much that it broke their teeth and they had to have crowns and stuff like that? Well, you know, we could say that they have I eat whole bags of ice disease, I suppose. My disease is I'm a pregnant lady and I eat chocolate ice cream by the gallon. Or we could do a blood test on them, find out that they're anemic, that their serum iron is low, put them on iron, and all of it goes away. In fact, it goes away so fast for the pregnant women that they become revolted when they remember that they ate that whole bag of carrots or they ate that whole gallon of ice cream. So we don't name their disease with their symptoms. We describe their disease by the abnormality that exists in the body. All right. Yes, the diagnosis describes the disease in the body rather than the symptoms. And to qualify as an illness, you have to have pathology. Now, we do have illnesses for which we do not understand the pathology. My wife sitting back there in the corner has migraine headaches. My daughter who looks just like her, our daughter who looks just like her, has migraine headaches too. Our daughter who looks a little like me doesn't. Now, we do not understand the pathology of migraine headaches to this day. And there's a real good reason why. It's because you really can't examine the brain of someone who's having one at the time they're having it very well. You just don't get a lot of information about it. So to this date, because we are technically unable to figure out what the pathology is, we don't know. But we assume it's a disease. So what I'm trying to tell you by that is that while all disease has pathology, all of it, every last disease that is real has pathology. We may not know it, and we may not understand it, but all disease has pathology. Now, going on, psychiatry, on the other hand, to contrast, Diagnoses are made on the basis of behavior. In fact, one of the real problems that people have when they write the DSM-IV is not to use the defined word in the definition. Did you ever have a teacher smack your hand in a literary sense over that? You know, she told you she wanted a definition for the word depression, and you used depression in the definition, and she says that won't work. Why? Because you can't use the word to define the word. And that's sort of what happens in most of the psychiatric diseases today. If you read down through the DSM-IV, all they are descriptions of the behavior that will be called depression or oppositional defiant disorder or rhinotelexomania. You guys know what rhinotelexomania is? It is the compulsive desire to pick your nose in public. It's a disease. Yeah, it's in the DSM-IV, and I actually think there's a treatment program for it. Anyway, they don't know why people do that. They haven't got the foggiest notion what the pathology is underlying it, but they call it rhinotelexomania, and everybody goes, "Ooh, what a word!" And all the word describes is what you do. Yes, that's all it does. It really doesn't describe what the deficit is in the human body that results in people having a compulsive urge to do whatever. Then they propose various theories to account for the behavior, and we've lived through a bunch of them. Freud was very popular until about 1960 or 1970 or so in the United States. You know, and it was what your mom and dad did to you. You know, your mother either dropped you on your head or somebody did something rather revolting to you, and as a result, you're scarred for life. And then there was Skinner, who said that we were a product of our training in our environment. You know, you live with nervous parents, you're going to be a nervous person. You work in a stressful environment, you're going to be an anxious person or something like that. That was Skinner. But now, mostly, it's fallen down to chemicals. Yes, we are now considered the sum total of the chemicals that exist inside our heads. Strictly materialism, that the mind does not exist apart from the body, that there is no soul, and that if we have problems, it's because some liquid inside our head is not in the right proportion or ratio to some other liquid inside our head, and as a result, then we have a disorder. Now, the difference between medicine and psychiatry, again, is pathology. Medicine defines this disease on the basis of changes in the human body that lead to symptoms. And I tell you, we are at our best when we do that. And we are at our worst when we depart from it. You know, the greatest miscarriages of medical justice that occur in the United States today are done so when we become artsy. You know, they used to call medicine the art and science. And the reason why they called it the art and science is because early on there wasn't much science. I mean, seriously, there just really wasn't very much science until about 1850. And so doctors' opinions actually, you know, carried considerable weight. But since 1850, we have been steadily moving towards defining a medicine in terms of something that you can see under the microscope and then something that you can actually do about it. Psychiatry, on the other hand, is still stuck back there with symptoms and theories. Desperately since about 1910, trying to figure out a way to look scientific. Since about 1910, they've been working on how to appear scientific because folks in the field of psychiatry understood that medicine actually had taken a turn and was becoming fact-based as opposed to theoretically based. Unfortunately, they're still stuck there. Now, why do people take medicine? Well, I always like to tell the story of a 40-year-old lady that I encountered probably now a good 10 years ago, and she's told me that I can tell her story. She was depressed and anorectic, and when I saw her for the first time, she was starving to death, literally. She would sit across from me in the counseling room, and I would ask her questions, and she would talk a lot like this. "Isn't that driving you crazy?" Yeah, it sure did me. The problem was that she didn't have enough sugar in her brain to think any faster than that. She was like a 486. You guys remember 486 computers? Yeah, didn't you feel powerful when you got yours? Yes. Oh my goodness. And then when you got the 250 meg hard drive that went in the place of the floppy drive, oh, was that ever power? 250 meg. Well, you know, I have jump drives in my briefcase which have more power than most computers did back then. Well, you know what happened when the hard drive got full on your 486 computer, and you were doing a Word document, and you would do spell check or grammar check or spell check, either one, and you would hit that button, and you could go to the bathroom, and you could wash your hands, and then you could go to the kitchen and make yourself a sandwich, and then you could come back, and it would still be doing whatever you told it to because it was running so slowly. Well, that's what this lady was like. She was like a 486 computer with a full hard drive. Her sister brought her in because she was near death. Now, you might ask the question, why was a woman who was near death sitting in a biblical counseling office? Don't you think that's kind of weird? Don't you think that somebody who's near death needs a real doctor? Come on, play along with me here. You know, wake up. Yes, it is a trap, trust me, but go along with me anyway. So you would think she would need a real doctor. Maybe you might even think she needed to be in a hospital someplace, wouldn't you? Yes, yeah, and maybe even taking medicine or something like that. I mean, because she was nearly dead, wouldn't you think she'd need that? Well, you know, there was only one problem. She'd been in the hospital three times by the time I saw her. She was taking three medicines, and she was under the care of a psychiatrist who actually met her absolutely nothing but good. I always tell people, I really don't try to get too critical of doctors for some reason. But you know, what he was doing for her, he was really honestly trying to save her life in the only way he knew how. He was an unsaved man trying to help someone living in an unsaved way to survive. That was what he was doing. And it wasn't working. It wasn't working at all. She actually was a believer. This lady was a Christian. Her sister who brought her was a Christian. And the only reason why they came to my place, which was up at Lafayette, was because they had been every place else, and this was sort of like the last stop on the railroad train. You know, the sister had absolutely no idea what to do with her. And at the end of that first hour, when I talked to her, the sister told me later that she thought I was nuts. And the only reason why they came back was because they didn't have any place else to go. You know, they had no place else to go, nothing else to do. And so they came. This lady was living by her feelings entirely. She would tell me, as I talked to her, that she just wanted to feel better. And, of course, she didn't really mean that. Now, I always caution folks whenever someone tells you that they want to feel better, that you really need to make them define it. And you really need to make them get down and tell you exactly what feeling better means. And what I usually do is I'll tell the counselee or the individual I'm talking to, well, would you tell me what life would look like if you felt better? If you could, it's like the easy button. You can do the easy button routine. If there was an easy button on this desk and you could just hit that button and it would change life to where you would feel better about it, what would life look like? And then she told me, boom, you know, what was going on. She wanted her ex-husband back. She wanted her ex-husband back who was a drunk. She wanted her ex-husband back who beat her. She wanted her ex-husband back who beat her kids. You know, by the time she got done telling us the story, all I could think of was that lady in South Pacific who sang that song, I'm going to wash that man right out of my hair. I mean, good grief, what is wrong with you? That's what we thought. You know, why in the world would you want him back? Well, you know, but idol worship is never logical, is it? No, we had stumbled into the idol of this woman's heart. And she had made this Faustian bargain, you know, the bargain you make with the devil. She thought that if she lost 70 pounds, that she'd be skinny again then. And then her husband would notice her. Her husband, who was married at that time to another woman, he would notice her, and he would then leave his second wife and come back to her. That was what feeling good meant for this woman. There was only one small problem to it. She had inadvertently put the goal weight about 25 pounds on the other side of dead. You know, she couldn't weigh that little and actually stay alive. So that was what made her situation difficult. But she would look at me with her big eyes with tears in them and say, "Doesn't God just want me to feel better?" Now, she didn't see God, couldn't see God in the trial. She didn't understand Romans 8, 28 and 29. Now, I know some of you have probably heard me say talk about this, but there, I think, are about 20 people here who haven't, and they need to. So bear with me for a minute if you have. I grew up in Baptist circles when I was a kid, and we all liked Romans 8, 28, but we only liked part of it. We liked the part that said, all things work together for good. And we would walk around with a silly grin on our face saying that to people when, you know, something had gone off in their life like a 1,000-pound bomb. You know, all things work together for good. And they would like to kill us. You know, that was usually their response. You know, you whited wall Pharisee, just get out of my life. Anyway, what does that verse actually say? It first says, "And we know," which means that we are going to operate our lives based on what we know, not on how we feel. Yes. And we know what? That all things... Do you know what that all in Greek means? You know, if you go into the Greek New Testament and look at it and parse it out real carefully, do you know what it actually means? Anybody? It means all. Just that. That's exactly what it means. It means all things work together for what? Good. Yes. All things. Good, bad, or indifferent. Right? I don't know why it is, but the good things usually don't drive us to our knees, do they? Generally, when the boss writes us the $10,000 bonus check, we don't fall on our face before God and cry out to him and go, "Oh God, what did I do?" And we're generally doing the happy dance down to the bank, right? Yeah, that's right. But what was it Lewis said? That pain is God's megaphone. Yes. And so when God sends difficult things into our lives, we become more tender and interested in what he's doing in our life. So all things work together for good. All things work together for good. To those who love God, this only works for Christians. Yes, we can't take the scriptures and distill Jesus Christ out of them and turn them into principles and expect them to work for people, because they don't. You know, this does not work for unsaved people. Evangelism does. All things work together for good to those who love God, to those who are the called according to his purpose, not mine. All of us like that verse in Philippians that says, "My God shall supply all your needs," right? We like that verse, don't we? The part we don't like about it is, though, is that God writes the need list, right? Yes. You know, we have aspirations and desires and wants, and they aren't always on God's list for us, aren't they? Are they? No, they aren't always that way. So my God shall supply all my needs. All things work together for good to those who love God, to those who are the called according to his purpose. And what is his purpose? That's verse 29. I never even knew there was a verse 29. It never crossed my visual screen or made an impression until I was in biblical counseling. For whom he did foreknow, he did predestine to be conformed to the image of his Son. And that is the purpose. So you put all that together, and what do you come out with? That God wants to use everything in our lives as the sandpaper of life to reshape us and make us into the image of Jesus Christ so that we can minister to other people. That's exactly what this is all about. You know, I was supposed to be in Houston on Friday night and Saturday teaching. I was. And I got to live out Romans 8, 28, and 29 for a day. I went to the airport dutifully. Had my ticket, everything was in order, had my carry-on bags, went down to the Continental desk. I tell you that because I'm probably going to fly on Continental again when the Lake of Fire freezes over. I'm not angry or anything like that, but anyway. So I'm on the plane. I'm sitting in seat 1A. I have my seat buckled. I have my Bible open, and I'm reading the Psalms. I'm not reading Psalm 23. I'm just doing my daily devotions. And I see the pilot get up and walk out and start talking to this lady outside, and there's something's not right. And next thing I know, he's getting off and walking around the plane, and Then he comes back in and says, better call the mechanic. And the mechanic comes, and within about 5 minutes, the mechanic has looked, comes in and says, you might as well get him off the plane. It's going to take a couple hours to figure out if we can fix it. It may take 6 hours to fix it. And to make a long story short, 8 hours later, I left the airport. And what happened was is that they finally canceled the flight. I was on standby for 2 more flights, and they were full, and so I didn't get on. And as I was telling Brad, I became very aware of how important I was in all of this. You know, I was like, oh, God's happy with me sitting here. And so finally, after 8 hours of sitting in the airport, I went home, because there wasn't another seat on any airline going anywhere near Houston for the next 2 days. I think airline flights now are a little bit like musical chairs. If you're not in your seat when the music stops, you're not going anywhere. Right? You know, it's like, and if they can't, and if you're playing bus, you may not get there for a week. Really, while I was walking around the airport, what I really wanted to know was, am I starting to look like Tom Hanks? You know. But you know what? God taught me a lesson. They went ahead and finished that conference down there in Houston, and I never got there. I guess God was okay with that. Wasn't he? Yeah, he was. It was just fine with him. Why? Because I didn't get there. If it had really been important for me to get there, I guess God would have arranged for me to get there, wouldn't he? Wouldn't he? And so, could I be angry about that? Could I yell at the lady at the desk? No, and I didn't. Like a good Pharisee, I didn't. Does that mean I was real happy about it when I left the airport? My wife would tell you, no, he wasn't happy at all. No. But by the next day, I had gotten over the dysphoria, you know, and decided I couldn't get depressed about this. Why? Because this is what God brought into my life, because he wanted to mold me for some reason, and I don't know what that reason was. I haven't got the foggiest notion why it was okay for me to miss that flight and for 2 other people to get on the next one, and I couldn't. It did, you know, I really don't know that, and God is not obligated to tell me. But I do know this, that all things work together for good to those who love God, to those who are the called according to his purpose. And my counselee didn't understand that. She didn't understand how God was actually working something good in her life when her deadbeat, drunk, wife-beating, child-beating husband dumped her and married somebody else. God helped the somebody else he married, but she was better off. She just couldn't come to grips with it. And that's what Romans 8, 28 and 29 tells us. That's what the scriptures tell us. All right, then, of course, she would always complain and tell us that the real solution to her problems was to fix her feelings. And we knew that she didn't know how to use the Bible or had refused to use the Bible to deal with her life. She was the first person that I ever said this sentence to, and this is a great sentence. You should write it down. It's very useful. And what I told her towards the end of the first interview was that if you want to get better, you're going to have to be willing to say this, and it is, I want to glorify God with my life more than I want to breathe. I'll repeat it. I want to glorify God with my life more than I want to breathe. And that's 2 Corinthians 5:9. Therefore, also we have as our ambition, whether at home or absent, to be pleasing to him. I can tell you this about counseling and about dealing with difficulties in life. People who will say that sentence and mean it can change anything that God wants to change in their lives. They can. And I can tell you this too, that people who don't want to say that never change. They will continue to live as they are when you meet them. So we taught her 2 Corinthians 5:9, and we taught her that if she really wanted to glorify God with her life, she was going to have to do what Jesus said in Matthew 22, 37 through 39. What was the great commandment? Love the Lord your God with all your heart and all your soul. That means you have to love the Lord your God more than you love your ex-husband. You have to love the Lord your God more than you want to be skinny. You have to love the Lord your God with all your heart and all your soul and all your mind, and then love your neighbor as yourself. Not love yourself so that you can love your neighbor. It is love your neighbor as yourself. The writer assumes that you love yourself. There's nothing in the Greek that justifies the idea of self-esteem in that passage. Love the Lord your God with all your heart and love your neighbor. And then if you love God, what will you do? Well, Jesus said in John 14, now that you know, he who has my commandments and keeps them. John 14, 21, he who has my commandments and keeps them, he's the one who loves me. You know, God defines what us loving him looks like. And what us loving him looks like is we're willing to do what the Bible says we ought to do when the Bible says we ought to do it. That's loving God. You know, it's sort of like loving your mom and dad. You love your mom and dad, you obey your mom and dad if you're living in their house and you're under their authority. Love your country, you obey your country's laws. You might even be willing to join the army and go die for it. But that's what love means in that sense. And then we taught her out of John 13, that whole chapter about washing dirty feet and washing the feet of the enemy. What did Jesus say right in the middle of it after he'd washed all their feet? And he told them, you call me your Lord and Master, and you're right because I am your Lord and Master, and I washed your feet. And then he says, you ought to wash one another's feet. And you know, the reason why he was up washing feet was because nobody else would. And then he said, and now that you know these things, happy are you if you do them. You know, what was Christ telling us? That if we wanted to be happy in life, we would be serving other people. That was where happiness was going to be, not serving ourselves, getting our own needs met in the way that we think that we deserve to have them met when we want them met, which was what was wrong with my poor counselee. All right, now, most often these people are told that they have chemical imbalances, which harkens back to Hippocrates. I'll talk more about that later. Hippocrates, 350 BC, he and others postulated that all disease was due to humoral imbalances. This will sound remarkably similar. And that everything was because every disease that man had was due to an imbalance between blood, phlegm, yellow bile, and black bile. Black bile, I suppose, being the worst. Okay, very likely they've been told they have a chemical imbalance. This is sort of a pictorial representation of it. The current medical biochemical theory of depression, anxiety, and any other behavior that you really don't think is very profitable is that there is an imbalance between serotonin, dopamine, and norepinephrine in your brain, and somehow this balance results in you acting the way that you act. And if we can go in there somehow and correct that balance, we can make that behavior go away. This, of course, is a theory, not a fact. An improvement of feelings as a result of the chemical that you take does not prove that there was a chemical imbalance, because that's one of the two tenets of the chemical imbalance theory. If I take an antidepressant and I get better, I had to have a disease, because medicine only makes disease better. It doesn't do other things. And if the medicine that I take is supposed to fix a chemical imbalance and I get better, therefore the chemical imbalance must exist, which is that kind of reasoning has sent medicine down a whole lot of very bad rabbit trails, trust me. And let's get an article here so that I can give you somebody else's opinion. We always respect people's opinions more when they're printed, don't we? Against depression, a sugar pill is hard to beat. Placebos improve mood, change brain chemistry in the majority of trials of antidepressants. This is by Shankar Vedantam, V-E-D-A-N-T-A-M, and it was in the Washington Post. It's not a biblical counseling journal. I don't even think it's conservative. No. Tuesday, May the 7th, 2002. After thousands of studies, hundreds of millions of prescriptions, and tens of billions of dollars in sales, two things are certain about pills that treat depression. Antidepressants like Prozac, Paxil, and Zoloft work, and so do sugar pills. A new analysis has found that in the majority of trials conducted by drug companies in recent decades, sugar pills have done as well as or better than antidepressants. Skipping down a little bit, you know what a placebo is? It is a pill that looks like but does not contain the active ingredient of the drug. It is supposed to work in double-blinded, controlled research where you split the group into two groups. You give half of them drug, half of them the placebo. Halfway through, you're supposed to switch. So, and hopefully what you see is the drug effect follow it. Now, in research that looked at the efficacy of St. John's wort. You all know what that is? That's the stuff you don't have to talk to the doctor about. You just go get off, and it's people believe it's an antidepressant. and it's a health food store thing. St. John's wort, and then Zoloft, which is a SSRI, selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor, supposed to affect this chemical imbalance thing, antidepressant, and placebo. They had three groups: St. John's wort, Zoloft, and placebo. The St. John's wort people, it cured 24% of the depressed people who took it. The Zoloft cured 25% of the people who took it, and the placebo fully cured 32%. This is not an isolated study. You know, people say, well, that's a fluke. No, it is not a fluke. This theme is being repeated over and over and over again with regard to antidepressants in the United States today. Interesting thing about the placebo group was that, guess what happened to them when they found out that they were in the placebo group? They got depressed again, yeah. All right. So just the fact that you get better because you take a pill doesn't mean that the pill had anything to do with it. Things related in time are not always related by cause. Almost anything that a doctor tells a patient to do when they are struggling in life will make them better. I don't care what it is. And the reason why is because at that point in time, generally, the patient is hopeless. If they weren't hopeless, they wouldn't be in your office. And if you tell them to go wash in the river 7 times, once they get over thinking that you're crazy, they'll get better. If you tell them to take a pill that has absolutely nothing in it, they will get better. And the reason why they will get better is because they have hope. That's the ingredient. Now, and I always say, you know, we have more to offer in the hope area when you start thinking about it. Now, some folks would say maybe sinful behavior has produced a chemical imbalance and medication is needed to restore it. My response to that is, well, how about repentance? Yes, repentance might restore it as well. Research studies have not proven the chemical imbalance-ish thing to be fact. All right. Sharon Begley. Almost lost it there. Sharon Begley, great writer. At this point was writing for the Wall Street Journal. This is November the 18th, 2005. Some drugs work to treat depression, but it isn't clear how. Now, this has to do with whether chemical imbalance is the theory for the treatment of depression is real. All right? Hardly any patients know how Lipitor lowers cholesterol, how Lotensin reduces blood pressure, or even how ibuprofen erases headaches. But when it comes to Prozac, Zoloft, and Paxil, ads and glowing accounts in the press have turned patients with depression into veritable pharmacologists, able to rattle off how these selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors keep more of the brain chemical serotonin hanging around in the synapses, correcting the neurochemical imbalance that causes depression. There's only one problem. Not a single peer-reviewed article, not one, not a single one, zero, supports claims of serotonin deficiency in any mental disorder. Scientists write in the December issue of the Journal of PLOS Medicine. PLOS Medicine is the public library of science. It is not supported by any drug money, and I mean legal drug money. It's not supported by money from manufacturers of ethical drugs. And I'm not talking about Columbia here. It doesn't take any advertisements from drug companies or from manufacturers of medical devices because they believe that is a conflict of interest. They cannot have a unbiased editorial policy if their ability to continue publication depends on whether or not the folks at Eli Lilly or Merck or someplace else like the research that is published. And there have been journals which have ceased to publish because of that. I think the British Medical Journal had a United States issue that went out of business because the drug company that bought most of the advertising in it pulled out. All right, now. Indeed, a steady drip of studies have challenged the serotonin did it hypothesis. A 2003 mouse experiment suggested that SSRIs work by inducing the birth and growth of new brain neurons, not by monkeying with serotonin. That's a joke. The joke is it's about the Eli Lilly studies done on Prozac that used monkey brains. They would feed the monkeys Prozac, and then they would sacrifice them, and then they would Cuisinart their brains, or blend their brains or whatever, and then assay them for serotonin, and thereby trying to determine that serotonin was higher in monkey brains if they took Prozac. One of the students that I've given this lecture to in times past asked, and it was a very insightful question, whether or not they asked the monkeys if they were depressed before they put them in the study. In March, a review of decades of research concluded that something else than changes in chemical imbalance might underlie depression. Just as Jeffrey LaCase, Jonathan Leo write in PLOS Medicine, although for ads for SSRI say that they correct chemical imbalance, there's no such thing as a scientifically correct balance of serotonin. How did so many smart people get it so wrong? Medicinal chemist Derek Lowe said, I worked on central nervous system drugs for 8 years, and I can confidently state that we know just slightly more than Jack about how antidepressants work. Now, that is the truth of the matter. We really don't know how they work. Now, once again, I don't say those things if you're because there are probably somebody here who's taking them. That is a Romans 14 choice and decision on your part, and I'm not here to criticize you. What I'm trying to get at is why do we prescribe them and whether they actually do what we think they do. All right. Now, so research studies have not proven it to be a fact. Somebody says, well, what if future research reveals the theory to be fact, or they find some other physical cause for behavior? And I would point out that there are all kinds of behavior that we're very much held accountable for in life that are determined before we're born. Most of it's hormonal. When you think about, this is always a dangerous place for me to go, but women. You know, are there hormonal things that happen in your life that, when 12 or 13, that suddenly your mood swing or something like that? Boy, you should see the dirty looks I'm getting up here right now. The guys are going, but the women, no. Well, that's true. Is it not true? Come on. Women's moods swing in relationship to their hormones. Is that true or not true? Yes, it's true. All right. Are women responsible for how they act in response to those hormones? Yes, they absolutely are. Okay, now let's even the score. Yeah, when boys hit 12 or 13, do hormonal changes occur that make them somewhat more difficult to deal with? Now all the women are smiling and they're shaking their heads. Yes, yes, absolutely. Tell me this, do we let rapists off the hook because they have testicles and testosterone? Boy, room got really dead there, didn't it? Boom, quiet. No, we hold them accountable for it, don't we? When I was a kid, we used to have a unique way of preventing recidivism with rape, with regard to rape. We killed them all. We executed them. I can remember as a kid reading, I was probably about seven, reading in the newspaper, and it talked about how up in Michigan City they had electrocuted a rapist. I didn't know what a rapist was. I went and asked my mom. I said, Mom, what is this guy? He's a rapist, and they electrocuted him. She said, ask your father. So, we hold people accountable for hormonal changes that occur in their bodies, even though they don't have any control or say over how those hormonal changes come. Correct? Well, that's what I would say about the question of future research. So there are true chemical imbalances in the body, but when they're present, the condition is no longer labeled as a chemical imbalance, but it's given a medical label. Some folks ask the question, wouldn't it be good to use medications to control bizarre behavior? And my response to that, in the case of schizophrenia and in the case of mania, I would say yes. But after those two things, most of the rest of it, it's sort of a flip. You know, it's a toss of the coin. When someone comes in and they're grieving over the loss of a loved one and they can't sleep, I don't really have too much trouble writing them for a sleeping pill for a couple of weeks. But you know, I don't believe that I'm curing a disease. And if they're still grieving in 2 months, which is actually when it kicks over and it's supposed to become major depression, you know, you can people grieve more than 2 weeks for losing their wife or their husband, and they can have rather sour mood about it for months, maybe even longer than that. And after 2 months, you call it major depression. I don't view that as a disease. Whether or not we treat them or not, unless they have schizophrenia and they're psychotic or they have mania, I think it's really a plus-minus thing because, well, you're going to find out that the effectiveness of the medicine is not all that great. Now, the questions that you want to ask people when you're trying to figure out whether the problems that they have are either emotional or physical, you know, whether or not these are underlying disease problems, or are they the behavioral diagnoses that so many people get today? You know, there's a whole list of them. And some of them have come and gone. You know, there was a premenstrual dysphoric disorder for a while that Eli Lilly wanted to sell Seraphim, which was just Prozac for. And that's kind of disappearing very quickly. It's, you know, nobody talks about it much anymore. Another thing that's kind of disappearing is chronic fatigue. You don't really hear very much about it. What do you hear a lot of, though? You hear a lot about fibromyalgia. Yes, right. You can see ads on television for a disease which has in common with chronic brucellosis and chronic fatigue and is no pathology, no underlying pathology to call it a disease. That's fibromyalgia. What tests were run to prove that a physical problem is present? Now, I better qualify my fibromyalgia statement. I don't mean to say that people don't hurt. What I'm saying is that when you go to a rheumatologist, and actually you don't go to a rheumatologist much for this anymore because rheumatology people say it's not a rheumatologic disease. And the reason why they say that it's not a rheumatologic disease is because there are no abnormal blood tests. Every rheumatologic disorder that exists on the face of the earth has abnormal blood tests. You know, have an elevated sed rate, an abnormal ANA, an abnormal RA. And so the rheumatologists are kind of falling off on this and punting it over to the neurologists and calling it an abnormality of pain perception. That's what they're calling it. Now, I'm not saying that people don't hurt. What I am saying is that we don't know the pathology that underlies fibromyalgia at all. And as a result, since we don't know what the pathology is that underlies it, the treatment of it can be it can be somewhat hazardous, particularly considering the side effects and problems that are associated with the drugs that we use to treat it. Now, how is it proven that the alleged physical condition is the cause of the emotional or behavioral actions? And how can it be proven that the recommended medication corrects the physical problem? What you're asking when you ask these things, like what tests were run to prove that there was a physical problem present, was there an abnormal blood test? Was there an abnormal physical exam? Was there an abnormal CT scan? Or was this something that was decided on a pencil and paper Hamilton depression rating scale, where you literally ask people if they're depressed and they tell you they are, and then you diagnose them as depressed? That's what a self-rating scale really comes down to when you look at them very carefully. Or the one that I like the most, it's when people stay up till 3 in the morning and they watch television. This is a marriage made in heaven. And they run the commercials. Lily runs the commercials either for bipolar disorder or depression. They run them at 3 in the morning. And the reason why is because depressed people, they don't sleep. And television time at 3 in the morning costs nothing. Yes, comparatively, you know, as opposed to buying ads during the Super Bowl. And so they watch the commercial, and it tells them to go to a website, and you're supposed to answer the questions on the computer. You hit the button, and it kicks out your diagnosis. And then you carry it to the doctor. And you say, "Doctor, I saw this commercial. I took the test. The test says I have this. And you're supposed to give me a prescription for it." Boom. And you know that 50 to 60% of the time, what'll happen? He'll write the prescription. No, he'll write the prescription 70 or 80% of the time. 50 to 60% of the time, he'll write it for the drug company that sponsored the website that the patient went to look at. So that's why you need to know the difference between the tests. What test was done? Okay. Now, some folks will say that the reason why they know for sure that they have a disease and that they need the medication is because the medication has made them feel better. And the question, of course, with my lady, that wasn't the case at all. She wasn't feeling any better. She was taking 3 different drugs at the time I saw her, and she felt absolutely no better. She, of course, had been told that she had a chemical imbalance and that she should take these medicines and they should make her better. Of course, she wanted to quit them. The first day I saw her, I don't know why that's the case. They always come in and they want to quit their medicine. "Can I quit my medicine?" That was what she said. And I smiled at her and said what every biblical counselor ought to say, and that is, "No. No, I didn't tell you to start them, and I can't tell you to quit them. That's not something for me to talk about right now." I did tell her, though, she could quit one drug that she was using all the time, and it was nicotine. Are you guys awake out there? Yes, yes, I told her she could quit smoking anytime she wanted to. But many people will come up. Whenever I do this, somebody will come up afterwards and they'll tell me, "I know that this is correct. I know that the medicine works, and the reason why is because I feel better." Now, then the next question I would have to ask you is how? How do you know? And Now, let's look at something here. The Bible teaches us that feelings are the result of thinking and doing. It gets back to that John 13, 17 verse where Jesus said, "Now that you know these things, happy are you if you do them." Jesus connects those three things right together: knowing, thinking, doing, and feeling. And it looks like this. This is pretty much how we all do it. We have a problem. We look at it. We decide what we think about it. I look at that lady who's supposed to be helping me get on the next airplane who isn't helping me at all. And I evaluate her. Anyway, and then while I'm evaluating her, I have emotional responses to it. And I'm supposed to have behavior that grows out of that. And sometimes the behavior will amplify the feelings, make them worse. And at times, always, problems in life responded to in an unbiblical manner produce unpleasant feelings. What would we expect? You know, why in the world do you think that God would want you to feel good if you're living in a way that disobeys Him? Well, it would be very counterproductive, wouldn't it? I mean, you know, the purpose for those of us who are living in a life in which we struggle and the struggles are of our own making is to drive us to God. You know, I remember Randy Patton sitting down and telling me on a very bad day when I thought I should be getting sympathy, and instead I got this, why is the sovereign God of the universe let this come into your life right now? What does He want to change through this? What does He want to change in you to make you more like Christ? That changed my life that day. So anyway, we can respond to it in an unbiblical manner, and we should expect to feel bad as because of it. And that looks a little bit like this. Boom. Now, how do we know if I take the medicine and I get better that the medicine actually had anything to do with it? All right, Newsweek. It's not a biblical counseling journal, right? Newsweek, this, and you need to get this article. It's February the 8th, 2010. Again, written by Sharon Begley. And it's really kind of cute. I think this was the cover. And at the top of it is, antidepressants don't work. And if you turn it upside down, it's antidepressants do work. And if you look at the pill on the front, it's frowning and crying. And if you turn it over, it's smiling. Yes. Good writing. Newsweek, February the 8th, 2010. Now, the Journal of the American Medical Association last month, this was January of 2010, the article, said that evidence that antidepressants work comes with a big asterisk. That's sort of like what they put after. Who is that guy in Atlanta that, no, in San Francisco, Barry Bonds. They always said they wanted to put an asterisk after his record because it was, you know, steroids. Well, this comes with an asterisk. Yes, the drugs are effective in that they lift depression in most patients, but that benefit is hardly more than what patients get when they unknowingly take, as a part of a study, the dummy pill, a placebo. As more and more scientists who study depression and the drugs that treat it are concluding, that suggests that antidepressants are basically expensive Tic Tacs. All right. Now, that's the Journal of the American Medical Association. This grows out of research that has been done over the last 10 years by a guy named Irving Kirsch. And he started in 1998 looking at the studies that drug companies provided and they published in order to take all of the published drug studies that looked at SSRIs and lump them. And what he found when he did that, and there were 37 studies, was that in all of those studies, if you added them all up together, that the placebo worked as well 72% of the time as the real drug did. Now, what that means is that 72% of the benefit in the active drug was due to placebo effect. Now, you might say, well, 72%, that's not real. You know, maybe that's not quite as important as you'd say. But then, when he was challenged on his research, and boy was he ever challenged, someone suggested that he do a Freedom of Information Act thing on the drug companies and make them give him their unpublished research. because there was a lot of it. There was just as much unpublished research as there was published research for all of the SSRIs, for Prozac, for Zoloft, for Paxil. And what he found was, by and large, the unpublished studies were those that failed to show a significant benefit from taking the actual drug. And when you factor in those studies, actually the placebo is up to 82%. In other words, 82% of the benefit from taking an antidepressant comes from the fact that the doctor looks at you, smiles, hands you the prescription, and says you'll get better. 82% of it. And it could even be more. And the reason why it could be more is because there's no such thing as a real double-blinded study when it comes to antidepressants. And the reason why there can't be is because the participants know when they're on the real drug and when they're not. And the reason why is that every last one of these drugs has side effects. And so if you take the pill and you don't feel any different, you know you're in the placebo group, which means that you surely don't think this is going to work. And then if you're in the, or you don't think it's going to work as well, and then if you're in the group where you know you have the side effects, it sort of pumps up the placebo effect. So it could very well be that the difference between the placebo and the real drug isn't much. What the article in the Journal of the American Medical Association said was that for all but about 13% of people who are diagnosed with depression, these medicines make absolutely no difference in their lives, period. That means that of the 30 million people in the United States today who take it, mostly they benefit from the idea that they will get better if they take the medicine that the doctor told them to, at a cost of about $10 billion a year. Now, that's what the real honest-to-goodness published factual statistics say. And if you go bug the drug companies about it, they will admit it. They know that they can't separate out, in 90% of the patients who take these drugs, they can't separate out the placebo group from the treatment group. Now, why do I say all that? The reason why I do is because we don't have to believe that people have depression because they take this medicine and they get better. We also don't have to believe that they have a disease because they take this medicine and they get better. And then we are free. We are free then to look at their behavior like I did with the anorectic lady and look at it through the scriptures and apply the scriptures to their lives so that they can change. That's the difference. You know, if you have someone come to the office, if I have a kid come to the office and he has a sore throat and a temperature of 102, and I stick a rapid strep screen swab in his throat and it comes back positive, you know what I'm going to do? I am not going to sit down, open my Bible to the Gospel of John, and start spending an hour talking to him about the reasons why he has a spiritual problem. Am I? And if I did, you would think I was crazy, wouldn't you? Well, a lot of people would think I was crazy. Instead, I'm going to write a prescription. Why? Because, well, I have a pathologic abnormality that requires me to treat it. Quite on the other hand, when I talk to people who are depressed, I don't know that there's any pathology that actually exists. And, well, neither do those who actually research it a lot. What they did find was that if you rated on a scale of 54 points taking antidepressants, that the effect of the antidepressant was worth about 1.8 points out of 54 of things that would benefit people who were depressed. And actually, a good night's sleep was worth 6 points. Now, you know, other studies that actually sort of weigh in or fall in on this was one that looked at, it's in that Newsweek article, that looked at doubling the dose. All right, now this becomes almost a really good double-blind study. You know, you go to the doctor, you take the 50 milligrams of Zoloft, you come back in 3 or 4 weeks and you're no better. So what does the doctor tell you to do? Anybody here know? Yeah, we're going to run you up to 100, maybe up to 200 before it's over, but we're going to run you up to 100. What they looked at in a large group of people was, what happens if you tell people that you're going to run them up to 100 and you don't, and instead you give them a placebo pill, and then in another group you do run it up to 100. Everybody was at 50, everybody's still depressed, you run one group up to 100, you run the other group up to 100, you don't tell them that you don't do it, but you don't tell them, but you give them the little pills that makes you think that they are. Now, the reason why this becomes a better study is because they still have side effects. They really can't tell the difference, you know, side effect-wise between 50 and 100. And what they found was that the people who doubled their dose actually got better 72% of the time. And the people in the placebo group, they got better 72% of the time. Yeah, that's right. It made absolutely no difference. Now, I tell you all that not to be critical of people who take medicine. Don't want to do that. The question, you know, remains, is it worth the side effects? Because there are side effects associated with taking these medicines. There are. They make people jittery. People will gain 25 pounds. There are significant sexual dysfunctions associated with taking the SSRI antidepressants. It makes some people more aggressive. It makes some people want to kill themselves. My cousin in California who had meningitis, a viral meningitis, and who had miserable headaches, and her doctor had read an article that Prozac helped headaches, put her on Prozac, and within 2 weeks, she wanted to kill herself. This lady's never had a day like that in her life. And she called her doctor up and said, look, you know, I want to kill myself. And he was wise enough not to tell her to double the dose. No, he told her to stop, and the emotions went away. So there are significant side effects associated with taking them. All right, moving on. Now, feeling-oriented people use their bad feelings as a reason for their inability to function. My counselee did do that. She couldn't work. She was on disability. I took it as my goal in life, since I was a taxpayer in the state of Indiana, to see to it that she got back to work. She also had her family take care of her, and her family was taking care of her. Her family was taking care of her kids. Family was doing everything for her. And the reason why she couldn't was because, of course, she didn't feel good. Medication is used to reduce the bad feelings. At least that's the theory. You stick the medication in the problem axis. And as we said, nobody knows how these medicines work at this point in time, particularly. When a person feels better because of the improved feelings, this gives the false impression that their problems are solved. And it doesn't get at the heart of their problem. And new drugs are continually developed because of the failures and side effects of the current ones. I would tell you this about that. And when the patents run out. You know, Prozac, when it first came out in the 1980s, the buzz around my town was is that we ought to all sneak up and take a 50-gallon barrel of it and climb up the water tower and dump it in the water system. That was how convinced folks were in central Indiana, since we live near Eli Lilly, that this drug actually worked and it did great things. You know, it was the promise of Prozac. Now, but the promise of Prozac didn't come through, you know, and eventually the patent ran out, and suddenly nobody talks about Prozac anymore because you can buy it for $4 a month at Sam's Club or Walmart or Kroger. And now the drug is Cymbalta. I mean, you know, the obvious cure for everything. Now, we would say that medication is not needed or even particularly helpful in helping people deal with biblical counseling problems. And when there's no proven organic cause, we ought to use the Bible. And that's what we did for my anorectic lady. Now, how would you go about doing that? Well, you need to do good data gathering. I always try to teach, when I teach people who are going to do biblical counseling, I tell them that the first thing you ought to do in that first visit is to listen for 30 minutes without interrupting them. Most people can't talk for 30 minutes. They'll run down before then. Of course, there are some who would talk an hour a week for the next 52 weeks and never let you say a word. I have a few people like that that I take care of. Sometimes I have to look at them and say, you know, you just talked all the way through your office visit. You'll have to come back next week because there's not really a whole lot more I can do about it. You know, they just burned up the whole time. But most people on that first visit, do you know how long the average doctor's visit actually lasts in the United States today? Anybody want to guess? I've heard 10, 4. Boy, that, you know, your doctor is fast. 2 minutes? Wow, they must heat the air up as they go by. Whoosh, actually it's about 12, it's 12 minutes. That's about the average visit. Do you know how long it takes for the average doctor to interrupt the patient once they start talking in order to turn the conversation so that it'll go someplace that they think is more profitable? You know how long you get? Anybody want to guess? Come on. It's not 10. 20 is getting closer. If you add the two together, it's 35. So the next time you go to the doctor, make sure you need to sit down and think about this before you go in so that you can get everything in that you want to tell them in the first 35 seconds. Now, what do you do if you do that when your counselee or the individual comes to talk to you? What do you think that tells them about you? It tells them that you're just like everybody else and you don't really care about what my problem is. And if you listen to them for that first 30 minutes, what do you give them? Respect. It's the H word. Hope, yes. Some of those people are going to walk out there and say that this is the first person that I can remember who actually has listened to me. They may be the only, and you may be the only person who actually, in a concerted, concentrated way, listened to them. And when you do that, you will give them great hope. Yes, you will, which is actually what most people are getting better with anyway. I mean, when you start looking at placebo studies versus drug studies, what you're figuring out is what people are really looking for in a miserable life is hope. Yeah. And when they struggle into your office and somebody has pounded it into their head that they need an antidepressant, really what's going on is that their life is hopeless and they don't see any way out of the swamp. All right, so you're going to listen to them. You need to learn what made those situations unpleasant. You need to spend considerable time learning about the problems in the patient's life or in the counselee's life before the medications were started. You want to learn what made those situations unpleasant. You need to learn how the counselee responded to them and what the goal was of each response. My anorectic lady had multiple unbiblical responses. She wouldn't sleep in her own bed at night. You know why she wouldn't sleep in her own bed? Anybody want to guess? Huh? Yeah, she didn't want to wake up alone. So she slept on the couch, which made her back hurt all the time. All right. So then you want to ask the individual what the goal of each response is. As they respond to the difficulties in life, when I was in pediatrics, they always used to tell us never ask a teenager why. Now, why don't you ask teenagers why? What do they say to you? Yes, it's, but they don't even say the words. It's, oh, you know, just like that. Do you know what the answer is when you ask a 40-year-old guy who's sleeping with a 20-year-old and he's married and his wife has just found out about it and they're both sitting in the counseling room and you're sitting across the table from him and you ask, well, why did you do this? Do you know what he's going to tell you? Yes, that's exactly what he's going to tell you. I don't know. That's because he wasn't operating on what he knows. It's something in the feeling realm, I think, or hormonal realm. Anyway. The better question is what was your goal? So, you know, as you talk to the counselee about how they responded to the difficulties in life, what you really want to be asking them is, what was your goal? If you ask them that, you'll actually find out something about them. With my lady, we found out that she was trying to get her ex-husband back. That was her goal. Then you need to ask them how the medication has helped each of these situations. You need to build involvement and give much hope. Yes, one more article. I'm not going to read it all to you, though. One more article. It's in the Washington Times, February the 25th, 2010. I just ran across this. And the first paragraph says, "The big man upstairs is getting accolades from mental health specialists who say they are finding that a belief in God plays a positive role in the treatment of anxiety and depression." Duh. What they found out was, amongst the people that they treated, that for individuals who believed in a God who cared about them, now, that was, you had to have those two things. You couldn't just believe in Buddha. Buddha doesn't care about you. No, you'll come back as something. You know, you'll just get reincarnated or something like that. And Allah doesn't much care about you, you know, or whatever. But for those who believed that in God and believed that God was actually concerned about their lives, they were 75% more likely to get better if they took medicine. Now, this was in a study where they looked at people who took medicine and their beliefs. And the people who believed in a God who cared about them were 75% more likely to get better. And I would tell you the reason why they were more likely to get better was because they had hope. Hope is a good thing. And we can give people that hope from the scriptures. All right, so you build involvement, give much hope. Don't be critical of people who take medicine. Don't be critical of people who go to doctors. I'll tell you this, don't be critical of people who go to doctors because the doctor may have sent them to you. You know, it may be the doctor who sat down and said, you need to talk to somebody. You know, it's like the little ditty I tell people. You know, it's like, I'll write this prescription for you. And I do write prescriptions for these medicines. I do. People demand them. I write them. I try to write them the ones that will cause them the least amount of trouble. That's what I spend most of my life doing, is giving people prescriptions for medicine that I think won't have terrible side effect withdrawal. Cymbalta, Prestique, Effexor, Paxil, those are hard to quit. They're all somewhat hard to quit, but those are worse. And so I'll generally write them a script for Zoloft, which I think is the easiest one to quit if you're going to have to pick one. So don't be critical of them because the doctor may have sent them to see you. We have one lady who goes to our church, who came to our church because the psychologist told her she needed to go to church. I'd like to meet him someday, because I haven't met too many of them that tell people that. So don't be critical of them. You need to teach biblical principles that apply to each problem and the presence of the bad feelings. With the biblical principles that we taught Our Lady, well, the first thing we told her was that she had to eat. What commandment do you think that I thought she was violating first and foremost? Out of the 10, the big 10. Well, let's get past loving the Lord your God with all your heart and all your soul. Yes, but after that, which one do you think I thought she was violating? Yes, exactly. Thou shalt not murder. Yes, that's because that's what anorectics are doing. They are manipulating everybody around them. Anorectic people are the most selfish people on the face of the earth. And you can don't be put off by that. Their salvation comes in understanding it. You know, the day they understand that not eating in order to manipulate people around them is selfish, well, they can get better. You know, it's like it's when they come to that point where they can say, I want to glorify God more than I want to be 10 pounds underweight. They can get better, but they are selfish people. And they manipulate other people by trying to kill themselves. So we made her eat, and I did everything wrong if we were talking to the anorectic people. We made her keep menus. We had her sister hold her accountable. Her sister was a registered nurse and a dear Christian lady and very instrumental in this lady getting better. We made her sleep in her own bed because she was supposed to be a steward of her body, 1 Corinthians 6:19 through 20. We made her go to church. Most depressed people do what when they get depressed? What do you think they do about going to church and reading their Bibles? They quit. Yeah, it's like the man on fire running away from the lake. You know, let me see how fast I can get away from all the help in the world that might be available to me. So we made her go to church. We also told her that, why? Because the Bible says so. We're not to forsake the assembling of ourselves together. We also told her that she needed to read her Bible and pray as a newborn babe desired the sincere milk of the word that she could grow by it. We made her read When People Are Big and God Is Small. I commend that book to your reading by Ed Welch. It's a great book. And she didn't like it a bit. And the reason why she didn't like it a bit was people were big and God was small. We made her get a job. Yes, made her get a job because she was a user in every sense of the word. And initially, since she was on disability, it was hard to get her a job. But we found her a job working in the family business. And the family owned a business. It was a donut shop. Took a while, but you got it, yes. That's right. And then we made her give up on her husband, her ex-husband. Why? Because the Bible says that if you've been divorced from somebody and that somebody has married someone else, you cannot marry them, even if they become single again, because God wasn't into the business of husband and wife swapping. And then I sent her off to do Christian service, 2 hours a week. And I would tell you, every depressed person that you ever come in contact with needs to do this. Why? Because it gets their nose out of their own belly button and into the lives of other people. And that person needs to be worse off than they are, worse off than they are. Someone who cannot pay them back, someone from whom they will take nothing. It cannot be a relative. There's always secondary gain in doing something for your mother-in-law. That one didn't work. Anyway, So, it's not going down to church and washing windows. It's actually doing something for somebody, that you will do it every week. You'll do it for 2 hours. She went and helped little old ladies do their housework, which became instrumental in how her life would go forward. All right, now, your primary goal in counseling is not to get people off medicine. Your primary goal is for them to live in a way that glorifies God and watch them grow and change and become more like Christ. I never talked to this woman about medicine again after the first visit, period. Now, I know when it was all over with, she wasn't taking medicine. And this was after she left when I was counseling her. But we never talked about it again. And that woman grew, changed, recovered, ceased to be an anorectic through all that whole process, and we never talked about medicine again. And I would tell you that that's probably the way it will work for most of the people that you talk to. So don't get fixated on whether they're taking medicine or not. Most of the time, most of the medicines people take will not affect their ability to be in biblical counseling and grow and change and become more like Christ. So push it off the table and sort of forget about it. Now, they won't. And again, our biblical goal in counseling is for them to become more like Christ through their problems rather than feeling better. And becoming more like Christ through the daily problems means that they need to handle or respond to them in a way that glorifies God and pleases Him. And you're going to teach them that from the Scriptures. And the Bible promises great victory in life, even when people can't feel better. And sometimes people just can't feel better, or they can't be well. And your goal is to teach the counselee how to deal with the problems biblically so that the medication becomes unnecessary. Now, sometimes people will say, I've been counseling this person for a long time, and I can't find any significant spiritual problems in their life, and so wouldn't medicine be needed? Again, I would say medicine is a Romans 14 issue. That's a choice for the counselee to make. I don't send people to get it because I don't really think it helps them all that much. But again, it's a choice that they would make. I would tell you this, though. If you hit a stump in counseling with somebody, you're in 6 or 7 weeks, and things just don't seem to be changing, you know what you really need to do? You need to understand that nobody tells you everything in the first 6 weeks they talk to you. And the reason why they don't is because they don't trust you. They don't know if you can keep confidences, and they don't know what you're going to think of them if they do tell you everything bad about them. And so I would encourage you that if you get to that stump at 6 or 7 weeks and things aren't going well, that what you really need to do is you need to go back and start over again. Start right back at the beginning. Sit down with them across the table from them and say, look, things don't seem to be moving along here. Is there something about this situation that I need to know that you haven't told me? And sometimes they'll tell you exactly what's going on and then you'll get a better sense of direction in it. Same thing goes on in medicine. You know, that's what we have second opinions for. You know, you get to the point where I've seen this patient 5 times, I don't understand what's going on, and I think I need to send them to talk to somebody else who hasn't talked to them so that they can get a fresh view of what's going on. All right, now if you get to the point after a year, you know, or not after a year, you get to the end of counseling, counselee's doing well, they have replaced their unbiblical habits with biblical ones, well, what are you going to do if it's time for them and they want to try to be off medicine? And everybody ought to get a chance, particularly if they're taking one of these kind of medicines that seem to operate mostly out of placebo. The first thing, keep in mind that it's not your job to take people off medication. As a physician in the state of Indiana, I don't tell counselees who come to me to stop taking medicine. I send them back to their doctor because that's the ethical thing to do. I didn't prescribe it. I didn't write it. It's, you know, and I'm not their physician. So I will tell them to go back to their doctor, their own doctor. Again, it's our task to find biblical solutions to their problems while they're taking the medicine. When they ask you to quit it, you need to ask what their reason for it is. Generally, the reasons fall into about 3 different categories. 1, it costs money. 2, they don't like the side effects. And 3, it still carries a stigma. You know, people who take medicine are people who take medicine, and people don't like to be known for that. When people bring that question up in the first visit, I always kick it off. I always say, look, we've got a lot of work to do, and we'll answer that question later. We're not going to deal with it tonight. And then you're only going to discuss it when you're convinced that they're using biblical principles in the place of the medicine. And when you are, you're going to send them back to the doctor who started them. And then you are going to do this. And this is how you do it. You tell them to go back to the doctor and you say, look, doc, I really appreciate what you did for me when I was so down. I came to you. You helped me. You gave me medicine. I have been in counseling now for 6 months or however long I've been in. And my life has actually changed a lot. And what I really want to know, doc, is, do I need to take this medicine for the rest of my life, or can I stop it? Would you help me gradually take myself off this medicine? And that's an important phrase, gradually take myself off this medicine so that I can find out whether I need to continue to take it or not. And I can tell you this, most doctors will say sure and tell them how to wean themselves off of it. And it needs to be weaned off. Almost all of these medicines have...